knew was important anyway. Mm-hmm. I was kind of weak in that area.
Weak in what area?
I mean, weak in just letting it roll off my back. It just looked like I carried it as a real weight with me a lot of times, you know. And but let me turn to a more pleasant side of it. Let me say this, that it was great in school to have, you know, I had really good report cards and things. And then at a point, now I don't know what grade I was in when this happened. Maybe this was because of overcrowding or something. Mm-hmm. But some of us had to leave that school, Esmont School, and take our classes in another building, which was a few yards down the road, you know, less than a quarter of a mile, mm-hmm. I'd say, less than a tenth of a mile down the road. And that was a building that had one large classroom upstairs and one large classroom downstairs. That was the extent of it. It was a two-story building, but that was all there was to it. And so I think I might have gone to that school 1 year. I'm not sure.
Was it for older kids?
Pardon me?
Was it for older kids?
No. This was like maybe when I was in the, I'm guessing now, third or fourth grade. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we went to that school. We called it the little school. It didn't have a name. And then years later, Burley was built. Mm-hmm. And so Esmont then was no longer a high school. It was just an elementary school.
Okay.
And so you went from the first to the seventh grade at Esmont. And this eliminated that little school. Mm-hmm. Okay. So from there, then you went to Burley. Now remember, I came out of a school, like I said, with no cafeteria, no gymnasium, any, you know, outdoor restrooms and all of mm-hmm. that, you know. Mm-hmm. So to leave all of that and go to Charlottesville, that was kind of a traumatic situation too, you know, because in the first place, we didn't really get to go to Charlottesville that much. You know, I didn't know Charlottesville.
Okay.
And it was very different from what it is today, where kids go everywhere. Mm-hmm, you know what mm-hmm, I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But when we went to Charlottesville, it was like, that was just a rare treat. You know,
right.
and we didn't go anywhere by ourselves. We went with our mother,
yes.
you know, or our father. And so when I had to go to school in Charlottesville, then I was trying to keep up with the boys, you know.
And which boys?
I mean, my buddies, my peers mm-hmm. in school. And many times they would do sneaky things and I would do it with them, like sneaking off from school and going downtown. But one of my
in Charlottesville,
you know, I mean, we'd just maybe skip a class, you know, mm-hmm. and go downtown. But it would frighten me half to death, and I didn't let them know it because I was scared I'd get lost.
You were cool.
I didn't know how to get back to the school.
Oh, that's great.
It's true. But I mean, this was when I was. Now remember, when I entered Burley, I was only 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
See, my birthday is in September,
mm-hmm.
and it's in the at the end of September,
ah.
which means that when the other kids were 13, I was only 12.
Yeah.
I graduated at 17,
okay.
where they were 18.
Right,
you see.
Right.
So, and then too, but now the other thing was this. I was only 12 years old, but I was 6 feet tall.
Oh, how confusing.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? And so anyway.
So what did you guys do when you snuck off?
Well, we would go downtown to the stores and maybe buy something and probably try to snitch something sometime. but really, not a lot of that. I mean, it was mainly just something to, just a daredevil type
sure.
of thing. You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like playing hooky. You mm-hmm, know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm, and so.
No girls did this with you, though.
Oh, Lord, no. My girls, man, I tell you, girls were so different than they are today. I mean, girls just didn't do the devilish things that boys did. You know
or
what
you
I'm
just
saying?
Didn't.
We didn't. maybe so. But anyway, we, the other thing was, now, over there, you changed classes. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
That was frightening, too.
From
sounds
room
crazy.
To room?
That's right. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? I mean, if you had six classes a day, you might have had six different teachers. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So that was confusing. Mm-hmm. I used to think I'd get lost in that school. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't like prior to going to Berlin, you went to visit it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You just, the transition was like, bingo,
yeah,
you're gone.
Wow.
You might have spent that entire summer between Esmond School and Berlin frightened to death
uh-huh.
of going there. You know what I'm saying?
Wow, yeah.
And so anyway, and then to have a cafeteria,
mm-hmm.
all right, that meant you had to eat before other people that you didn't even know.
Oh,
you
in
know?
Front of?
Yeah, in front of other people.
Huh.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I know these things don't sound like anything to you because you're young and
well, it's such a different
it's a now. That's right, it's a different era. But I'm telling you, to have to do things like that in front of people that you know,
well,
I always
you done at Esmont in the for lunch.
In Esmont, you carried your lunch in a bag and you could take it out there in the woods and eat it if you wanted to,
in
you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Is that what you did?
Yeah. Well, not necessarily. I mean, maybe I had two or three little guys
yeah.
who were my friends that we ate together.
Okay.
You know
okay.
what I'm saying?
Right.
But this would be a cafeteria full of people, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a table full of, especially girls who are very bashful. Daddy over there watching you eat. I didn't even know how to properly use a knife and fork, really. We ate with a spoon. You know
okay,
what I'm saying?
Yeah. So a lot of
now,
anxiety.
Sounds crazy.
No.
But it's the truth.
Yeah.
And so, and you had to have, you know, you had to have money for your extras, milk and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and Lord, you didn't dare take lunch to school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that would have been the pits, you know. So that was kind of a hardship for mom and daddy, but still they did it, you know.
Gosh.
And the other thing was, and that when you went to gym class, see, you had to, you know, participate in some very rigorous sports, you know, I mean, you know, and then you had to come back and shower, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-oh.
And you see what I'm saying? That's before other people too. You
yeah.
know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
And so you just don't know the impact that some of these
especially
things.
Especially 12 years old.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And
well, but you survived.
Yeah. But it was tough. I tell my wife all of this now, and she gets the biggest laugh out of it.
Well,
but,
so did you? Well, what were you saying?
Well, I was just going to say that you just don't know how these things compounded the fears that were in you. You know what
mm-hmm,
I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as time went on, you know, mm-hmm. and you weren't the underclassmen, you know,
mm-hmm.
you after a while, you were in the 10th grade or the 11th. Well, then you had done it for so many years,
mm-hmm.
man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know, you didn't mind it.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to get there,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And,
what was it like being, yeah, one of the older guys? Did you date when you got to be that age?
Yes, but let me, I tell people this and they don't believe this, but I was so bashful
mm-hmm.
in school.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really was. Mm-hmm. I mean, my self-esteem was pretty low and, you know, I knew, I guess, to some degree, I was kind of like living two lives in a way,
mm.
you know, but always inside I knew who I was,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and that was frightening.
Who you were
so,
inside?
Yeah, really. Mm-hmm. And so I was very, very bashful of girls. I really was.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wasn't comfortable with dating until I was, now I didn't say I didn't have a girlfriend. I mean, I liked girls, maybe sometimes who didn't even like me, but but I liked them anyway. But I guess I didn't really get comfortable with dating until I was maybe, I would say at least in the 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the 10th. Mm-hmm. And see, even in 10th grade, I was still only like 15 years old, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So, and then, now remember dating, if it wasn't like, you know, I took my dad's car and went.
Yeah.
Dating for us was like a group of guys, you know, mm-hmm. going out to try to mix with girls at mm-hmm. parties and so mm-hmm, forth, you know. Mm-hmm. But.
Or dances.
Yeah, dances. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. And then, too. A lot of the places that had public entertainment, you know, for African Americans were very rough places.
Mm.
Very rough places.
In Charlottesville? Or
yes, in Charlottesville. Uh-huh. Well, yeah. Both places, really. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times when they had house parties, you know, at different places here, a lot of times it was very rough houses.
Mm.
You know what I'm
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, sure.
And then there was drinking and, well, they just weren't places that your parents were glad to have you at
a lot
of times, you know. But
would you be allowed to go to those parties?
After I got a certain age, mm-hmm. My parents didn't really put the brakes on me, but they gave some very strong advice and, mm-hmm. and some cautions and things, mm-hmm. you know what I'm
mm-hmm.
saying?
Yeah.
And even though I didn't always adhere to it, it was almost like I could always hear them right in my ears, you know what I'm saying? I always knew.
Perched on your shoulder.
That's right, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think I got comfortable in that when, like I said, probably somewhere between the 10th and 12th grade, mm-hmm. and I don't think it really got that's the wrong word, because I don't think I really became comfortable with it
mm-hmm.
until I actually left home.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated from high school mm-hmm. and then I went 4 years into the military mm-hmm. and I really think that is when I became who I now am.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Came into your own. Yeah.
It came into my own.
Sure.
It's the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, really, because
that makes sense.
I mean, I was away from everybody who knew me, and I only came home 2 times in 4 years.
Hmm.
This is true.
Hmm.
But it was an experience that I'll probably never forget. It's the truth.
Being in the Army.
Oh yeah, in the Air Force I was.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, but school was good, and I'll tell you something else. I had a very wrong conception about what could and couldn't be done as far as furthering my education.
Hmm.
Now, I had 1, 2, 3 older siblings who had gone to college, and one had graduated and you know, gotten her degree. One had become ill and had to drop out of college. She later, many years later, went back and got her degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother, who had gone to college, for whatever reason, he dropped out, and I don't know the details of it. They are much older than I.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, at the time when I came along, I knew things were tough for my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't know a lot about how to go about getting assistance to go to college and everything. And I'm not saying it wasn't available, mm-hmm. but I didn't know.
Yeah.
And so I just resigned myself to the fact that I was going to go into the military and make a career of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was 17 years old when I graduated, and I immediately went to my parents and told them that I wanted to go into the military, and I wanted them to sign for me.
Mm.
And they said no.
Oh.
Now, all of my older brothers had been in. And my mother and father and all of their experiences had been, you know, reasonably good. But my parents were very wise. See, they said, now, we don't mind you going, but you're going to have to wait until you turn 18 and make your own decision.
Hmm.
Because if you go in there because we signed for you and you don't like it, you're going to forever feel like if only they hadn't signed. And it was wise. So I left home at 17 and went to live with my brother in New Jersey and his wife.
What was his name?
My brother Monroe.
Okay.
Yeah, and I went to live with him and his wife in Newark, New Jersey. And the very day that I turned 18, I went down and volunteered for the military. And they were very slow calling me, so even though I passed the test and all of that, they just, you know, they have a time that they do these things.
Yeah.
So I left Jersey and came back to Virginia and signed up again down here. And they called me, and so that's when I went in. And like I said, now I wouldn't take anything for the time I was in the military, even though I didn't really love it like I thought I was going to love it. And I think it was so wise what my parents did by not signing for me. But by the same token, and I thought I was going to make a career of it, and obviously I didn't. But I can tell you now that it was one of the best experiences of my life. It really was. I mean, because it was a time of growing up. It was a time of having to do for myself. It was a time of, you know, you don't have time to be a boy anymore. You gotta be a man here. And it did so much for me in so many ways, you know. And I'm a disabled veteran today, and not 100% disabled, but I'm a partially disabled veteran. And I tell you, the benefits that I have received, you know, hospital care or all of my medicines and everything, I just thank God for it. I really do. I really do. So what I think what I was leading to say was that I made the mistake of not going to college. I really did, because I thought that my parents couldn't possibly send me to college. My kid brother came right behind me and got his degree. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And even when I was in the military, there was a young man there named Craig Chamberlain who was from Clifton, New Jersey. He and I were quite close friends. Young white fella, incidentally. And he said, James, look, let's go to college here in the military. And by that time, my attention was totally on having a good time.
After all of that,
that's right. You know, I mean, when I say having a good time, I mean, I had girlfriends and I just loved it. I really did. You know? And so, anybody said, let's go back to school, man. That's right. And so, but he was so wise and he was right. And so, like I said, I should have done a lot of things differently, but still I wouldn't trade it either, because you know what I'm saying?
I do.
I learned a lot. I really did. And if I had it to do over, though, I think I would go on to school. But the Air Force, they recognized when I was in there not very long at all, they wanted me to go to officer, what they call officer training school in the Air Force. And I considered it, but they said, and then I gave it up quickly because it said your enlistment will automatically be extended for 2 years. And
yikes.
See, you'd be surprised. 2 years, you and I know 2 years is gone like that.
Yeah.
But when you are 18 years old,
it's forever.
You see what I'm saying? And so I said, 2 years more? No, God, I'm not going to do it. You know what I'm saying? Which was, all of these were dumb things, but I learned a lot from them, you know?
Yeah.
So I said, no, I didn't do it. And of course, now I wish I had done that. But I'm still thankful because it was an experience that I wouldn't have had anywhere else.
No.
And I guess I can't say very much more today, I don't guess, huh?
Is that today?
No, I mean, haven't I talked enough on one day?
Oh, let's pause because... Okay. October 30th, Tuesday afternoon, I am with Mr. James Jordan for the second part of our interview. This is Sarah Lawrence, continuing on with part two.
And my first question, wrap-up questions, is your service in the Air Force that you were told me about last time briefly. Did it change you in any way that you think is kind of fundamental, and or did it change how you perceived your life here in Esmont when you came back?
Well, let me say this. I believe it would be very difficult for any young man to go into the military and not come back unchanged. Now, that could be a negative or a positive change. But I think for most, it's a real, real positive change. Mm-hmm. Because for me, I graduated from high school when I was 17 years old. I was tall, like I am now. Mm-hmm. But still, I was youthful in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, I was only 17. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a lot of experiences in the world. And so it was a time for me that, well, let me put it to you like this. When I got out of high school, I asked my mom and dad if they would sign for me to go into the military, because mm-hmm. you couldn't go in under 18 mm-hmm. without your parents' consent. Mm-hmm. And they decided that they would not sign for me, even though they had 6 sons prior to me who had gone into the military. And they decided they wouldn't sign because they said that it was entirely possible that I might go in and not like it. Mm-hmm. And the branch of service that I was going in, wanted to go in, the Air Force, requires 4 years. So they knew that that would be a long time to be in a situation that I didn't like. And I think just by virtue of our human nature, we tend to try to throw off on someone else what our negative experiences are, you know. So they felt like I would forever be blaming them that, you know, had they not signed, I wouldn't have been there. Well, anyway, when I went in, it was I'd have to say, a life-changing experience for me, because, first of all, I hadn't had a lot of interaction, close interaction, with white people. There was only one family in Esmont, white family, that was really close to the African Americans, you know, and that was because they lived in this area. Mm-hmm. And
who were they?
That was the Moore family. Mm-hmm. The Moore family. And I'm saying because they lived here, but I don't think it was really that. They were really special. Mm. They were special. Now, that doesn't mean that they catered to everything that we wanted.
Right.
I mean, the guys were, they were just typical guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, if things were going well, it was fine. If it wasn't going well, they would fight you just mm-hmm. like anybody else would. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, and I can remember vividly that Mrs. Moore many times would be sitting right in our home with my mother, and they would be laughing and talking like sisters. And the boys would come over, and there was at least one girl in that family. I don't remember a lot about her. She was kind of one of the older ones, I think. Mm-hmm. But the younger boys that I knew would come over and play ball and whatever, and when time came to go in the house and eat, they would come in and eat, and it was just, you know.
That was when you were a kid.
That's right, you know. But I'm saying, I was trying to relate that to what I experienced when I went into the military.
Yeah.
So when I went into the military and found myself in the midst of a real integrated society, well, it was a really new experience for me. And even though, as I said, I did get to know the Moore family quite well, but they were by far the, I guess they were not at all like the other whites
sure.
in the area.
Yeah.
Okay, they were by far the exception to the rule, is what I was trying to say.
Were they native to this area?
I don't really know that. I think they might have moved here from somewhere, but I don't know where. But they were really decent people. And anyway, most of my experiences with whites in this area where mm-hmm. I lived had been really negative, mm-hmm. really negative. I remember an occasion where a police officer tried to, he talked about arresting me.
Mm-hmm.
And for something I hadn't even done. You know, mm-hmm. I was sitting in a place where some guys were drinking, and as the police officer went by, someone said a cuss word.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he came into the group and like, you know, come on, you going with me.
Mm-hmm.
Just to me. And I said nothing. And my brother and one of my brothers and some other men who knew me quite well right there, they said, oh, no, indeed, he's not going because he didn't do anything, you know. And none of them actually said they did it either, but mm-hmm. he just had the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
So it was negative experiences like that that I equated with white people.
Yeah.
And so when I went into the military, I met some guys who were, honestly, they were just, I, for lack of a better phrase, I would have to say soul brothers in a white skin. They were really decent dudes.
Uh-huh.
And my wife will tell you, I often tell her, one of the most decent young men that I ever met in my life was a young white fella from Clifton, New Jersey, named mm-hmm. Craig Chamberlain.
Mm-hmm.
And Craig was, he was just the cream of the crop.
Mm-hmm.
Really. And Craig even tried to get me to further my education in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so busy with the ways of the world until I just mm-hmm. didn't do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I still remember him well to this
mm-hmm.
day, and many of the others too. So the life-changing part of it was that, first of all, it opened my eyes to the fact that basically people are people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good to know. It was good to know that black and white could all live under the same roof. And when I say live, I mean eat together,
mm-hmm.
sleep together, work together, play together,
mm-hmm.
worship together, everything,
mm-hmm.
you know. We could all live under the
yeah.
same roof
yeah.
and get along like people should get along, you know. And so I was in this environment in the military for 4 years, and just about the time that I was ready to be discharged, they had the Cuban crisis was going on. And so my enlistment or my discharge was threatened at that time. That
mm-hmm.
you know, they had let us know that we definitely would not be discharged
mm-hmm.
if that culminated into anything
mm-hmm.
serious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so so when that died down, well, of course, I left the military and I went ahead and got my discharge. And then had to come back to a situation that was almost forgotten in my mind
yeah.
because in 4 years of military, I only came home twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in that real friendly environment. And when I say friendly, I mean among everybody, real friendly environment for 4 years, and then came back here and found that things really hadn't changed in Esmond. And so I had a really hard time dealing with it. I came back here and I don't know, I had been in a city, I've been in San Antonio, Texas for 4 years, which is a city of I guess more than half a million people, I reckon. And it was a real fast lifestyle and you know, the bright lights and just
mm-hmm.
all the entertainment you ever wanted. And then to come back here to Esmont, which hadn't changed, really. And so I just couldn't take it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a brother who lived in Charlottesville who was single, and I was single at the time. And so we decided we were just going to move away and just weren't going to make Esmont our home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we took the names of about four places and wrote them on a piece of paper and just, you know, on an individual piece of paper and just put them in a hat and shipped the hat up and said, whatever comes up.
You make decisions, I make decisions.
That's right. So that's where we were going. And I know one of them was, I believe, Boston. Los Angeles was one, and what the other two were, I just can't remember. But Los Angeles came out of the hat, you know. And so I had money saved from the military, and we were both free, you know, you weren't married or anything, single men. So we left and went to Los Angeles, and really with no intention of coming back here to live.
Yeah.
And so I went out there, and it kind of was a very, you know, similar environment to what I'd been in for the last 4 years, and that was good. Well, anyway, after having been there a while, I went up there and worked in a bank, Bank of America, out there for a while, training anyway to be a teller out there, and I didn't really like that much, even though that was the only job, that decent job, you know, that paid well, that I found. So my dad became ill, really seriously ill. He had had probably one, possibly two heart attacks before we left. But then, you know, he became ill again. And so there was no one at home at that time but him and my mother. Mm-hmm. So then I decided to come back and came back into the area. And I had to look for a job, of course. And I was staying with my parents at that time. And it was the weirdest experience because I didn't know anything that black men did except, the really menial types of jobs. And I didn't want to work in a quarry like my dad had worked in and you know, anything like that. I had tried pulpwood, if you know what that is, hauling and cutting pulpwood, and that is just, I can't tell you how difficult that is. I had done construction work and was doing construction work at the time because when I came back, that was the first job that I found, a construction job. And so I knew I wanted to do something different, so I started going around to different places to, you know, apply for employment. And
just in Esmont or elsewhere?
In Charlottesville.
Okay.
In Charlottesville. And I got a real break because I went to Sears Roebuck, and among other places. But I went to Sears, and I submitted the application, and, you know. And so at this time, what happened was the boss, the manager, was there. And I guess it was probably just his common practice that when you submit an application, he would look at it right then while you were there. And so he looked at it, and he said, I've got a test I'd like you to take. And I didn't know what it was about. So anyhow, I went ahead and took the test and gave that back to him. And he said, James, he said, on your application, you applied for, I've forgotten what they call them, but anyhow, people who clean the store, I guess they were called porters or something, I don't know what they were, but anyhow, he said, you applied for either that or to be a truck driver's helper. And I didn't know anything else that black men did there. And so he said, I'd like to try you. He said, I'd like to hire you, and I'd like to try you in another area. And I asked what that would be, and he said shipping and receiving. I had no idea what shipping and receiving was. I remember, I was born and reared right here.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
And when I went into the military, I didn't do anything in any shipping and receiving, so I didn't know what it was. And but I didn't say that to him, so I just said, okay, you know. And he put me back there in shipping and receiving, and just to make a long story short, I stayed there 5 years. And I tell you the truth, it was an eye-opening experience for me. It let me know that with proper training, I could probably do many, many, many things if just given the opportunity.
And when was that? Mid-60s, when was that?
This was in, I guess, around 64.
Okay.
This was 64.
Okay.
And so, anyway, like I said, he put me there, and I even had the opportunity while I was there. I did all of the store shipping. I helped with receiving merchandise, pricing it, and taking it out to the floor and so forth, you know, and checking quantities and checking for damage and things like that. Did all of that. And also, I had the opportunity to be the first African-American salesperson. I said the opportunity. Now, I didn't take advantage of it. But they wanted me to be the first African-American salesperson that Sears Roebuck had in Charlottesville.
Wow.
That's the truth. Now, guess what? It frightened me, the idea.
Oh,
it really did.
Yeah.
It frightened me, and I didn't take it. But, but you know, I could have, and to this day, I realize that it was a mistake. But anyway, sometimes you have to make some mistakes in life to learn some things, you know.
No, you were probably the only black person at that level of shipping receiving.
Oh, I was.
Yeah.
I was. As a matter of fact, the only other black persons, men anyway, in the store was guys who were the cleaning guys. There were some in the warehouse, you know, some, I don't know if any of them drove trucks, but I know they worked as truck drivers, helpers. And there was a lady who did alterations in the store, you know, and other than that, that was it. And so it was a pretty, you know, high-level job for, even though, you know, today I know it's not really a high-level job, but it was comparatively speaking, you know. And so that was a good experience.
Yeah.
It really was. I don't want to take too much time
on
one question.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. I just want to
But the military, let me just say this one thing for the military again. I'm a disabled veteran, okay? And a lot of people think when you say disabled veteran that you were in a war and got shot or something like that. Doesn't mean that necessarily. I'm just disabled by virtue of what physical problems I incurred while in the military and came out with. And so anyway, I would say this, that for any young man, even in this time right now of war, I think the military is just a wonderful, wonderful place to be and to learn, growing up, learn, interacting with other people, and it has potential for growth and success like very few places I know.
All right.
I mean that.
Okay. The names of the Moore family. I'm just curious if you remember any of the names.
Okay. Now, like I say, I don't know what these people will think. This is going to be in print somewhere, is it not?
Well, you said a nice thing about them.
Well, that's right. Okay. The lady was Mrs. Elsie Moore.
Okay.
That was the mother.
Okay.
And now her sons, and I can't remember that daughter's name. Uh-huh. I think her name might have been, don't quote me on this, ask some of these other people you're going to interview.
Okay.
If they're older than I am, ask them. That girl's name might have been, I don't know. I better not say it. For some reason, I think it's Dorothy, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
And the guys were, that I remember, one was killed. One was killed. I think he might have, you know how guys will just upset. This was, I think he was killed by the ice truck, is what they said.
Oh.
They said that he was maybe on a bicycle and had grabbed the back of the truck, and the man was, you know, in some way he was killed. Yeah. I don't know how.
Huh.
But Earl was his name. Earl Moore, I think. I'm not, put a question mark there, because I'm not sure that was his name. But the ones I remember was Ray Moore and Lawrence Moore.
Okay.
Now, Lawrence was, I think, the youngest one of them.
Okay.
I knew Lawrence better than Ray, but I knew Ray also. And the dad, that's funny, I don't know what his name was. He was there, but I just, Mr. Moore, that's it. But I did know his name, Henry Moore, I believe.
Okay.
Put Henry in a question mark.
With a question mark. All right. You told me about the midwife who delivered you. Could you just encapsulate that story again?
Don't let me go on and on.
I'll cut you off.
To the best of my knowledge, okay, that lady's name, now let me think of it again, was Mrs. Fanny Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Fanny Ford, I think. And I talked to a friend of mine. I won't call her name right now, but anyway, I talked to a friend of mine in this community. Well, I think you interviewed. Did you interview Lorraine?
Not yet. We're going to do her.
Okay. Well, anyhow, I'll just tell you that's who it was.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Lorraine. That's that cord falling, I think. I talked to Lorraine and about this very thing, and she told me that there were other midwives in this community, too. I didn't know that. The only one I ever heard of was Miss Fanny Ford.
Mm-hmm.
She also told me that Mrs. Ford did have a family of her own. Remember I told you, I didn't think she had a family?
Yeah.
Well, she said Miss Ford was actually Mr. Von Ford's mother and some others in this area. I don't know them all.
Mm-hmm.
So she did have a family.
Okay.
But she did. Her reputation, as far as I know, was that, she delivered a good number of the babies in this community.
Mm-hmm.
And
all the ones in your family.
I think everyone. Mm-hmm. I think now that may not be true because my oldest brother and sister were born in Sandroad, which is it's kind of like Esmont, but another area of Esmont. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But they were born in Sandroad, so I don't imagine without transportation such as we have now. You know, most people walked or went by a horse and wagon or whatever, and she probably wouldn't have gone there.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say the younger ones of us, you know, and my mother and father had 12 children. I would guess maybe 8 out of the 12 she delivered.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing.
And do you remember meeting her, seeing her?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I remember seeing her, but now only to, not to know that she delivered a child. Now, crazy, let me tell you what's really crazy. I have two in our family. I had a brother and my sister are younger than I. Now, I don't ever remember my mother being pregnant. Now think about that. I really don't. And yet I'm 5 years older than my sister.
Wow.
But I don't remember my mother being pregnant. The only thing I remember, I don't even remember anything except all of a sudden there was a baby.
Wow. Well, some women don't show it, I guess.
Well, I don't think that was the point. I think Mama might have. Now, I don't know. But I just think that we, even if she, her stomach was big, we didn't know. Uh-huh. Why, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, she just ate a lot that morning.
And yes. And then, too, when I think now that I was only five, mm-hmm. but five-year-olds can be very inquisitive. You
yes,
know that.
Yes.
But I swan it, I don't ever even remember my mother being pregnant. Huh. So I guess, yes, she did deliver a lot of us, you know. But Mom and Dad had my older brother and sister and at least one other brother before they moved to the house mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. most of right here in Esmond mm-hmm. that most of us were born in, okay?
And can you describe Mrs. Ford generally?
Not well.
Not
at
physically,
all.
But like her reputation.
Oh well, I think her reputation was great. I really do, because she I believe was a very kind, caring person. I don't believe that she delivered children at all for the sake of the money. I don't believe that, you know, and yet I believe that she might have been given something. Mm-hmm. But these families were extremely poor. And I can remember when a lady used to come to our house and help my mother at times, mm-hmm. and all my mother could give her was maybe some food or, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Money, you know, mm-hmm. people just didn't have it, mm-hmm. really. So I think she did what she did out of love, and if someone did wish to give her something and could give her something, she might have taken it. But other than that, I think it was just a love of people,
yeah.
really, you know, was the motivating factor, yeah. I would think. I really do.
Did she treat your family for other things?
Not to my knowledge. You know, they had a public health nurse that came through here in my young days, and this was a white woman, Ms. McFarlane. And there were, as Lorraine told me, there were other women in the community who did some of this midwife mm-hmm. thing and you know, delivering babies mm-hmm. And at least one of them was a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that many people in the community really realized that until this woman was deceased.
Hmm.
But I mean, this is an African American woman,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't think, you know, I mean, maybe she didn't practice nursing here. You know, maybe she went when she came here.
Yeah.
I just don't know.
Maybe at the hospital.
But I don't think she did it at the hospital either.
Huh.
You see? I mean, because I don't know where
she
came
married?
From. Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. it was just her and her husband. Mm-hmm. Ask Lorraine about Miss Alice Nielsen.
Alice Nielsen? Okay.
Miss Alice Nielsen, African-American woman.
Okay.
Who I believe was a nurse. I think Lorraine confirmed that to me.
Okay. One more question. Mrs. McFarlane.
Uh-huh.
How was she received from the community?
Well, Ms. McFarlane, I think, was received well because, you know, she was paid, I guess, by the county or somebody mm-hmm. to come to this area and, you know, administer shots and do certain things that mm-hmm. preventive types of things,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a very friendly woman.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people knew that they needed her services.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there was any charge at any time for anything. I don't know.
Did she do it at a school or church?
She went to people's homes.
Homes, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. And that was in the 30s when you were a child, did you say? Or 40s?
But look, I don't want everybody to know
my age. That's right. The taboo subject.
And so I've given you some dates on some things.
No,
but
you
don't tell my dates.
Okay. Anyhow, I'm just trying to get a sense of the history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think I am done with my questions. Is there anything you can think of that you'd
you
like to add?
I thought you had a third question. Did you have a third question?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes.
Yeah,
you had mentioned changes in the church.
In the church.
Over time, yeah.
Yeah. I, could probably say that in a very few words, and that is prosperity tends, unfortunately, to diminish in people's minds their need for God. Okay? And that's not unique to Esmont. You know, that's unfortunately a worldwide, I believe, problem. Mm-hmm. Well, when I was young and families were really, really poor, we were so strong in the church, mm-hmm. so strongly dependent on the Lord, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And even though in reality that dependence hasn't changed, you know, we need the Lord more today than we did then. But unfortunately, many don't see it. And so as a consequence, you know, our churches are not full as they should be, you know. And even many times, I feel like with those who attend are there physically, and sometimes not really mentally at all, you know. So it's very unfortunate because Jesus is coming back. Believe me when I tell you, Jesus is coming back. I was reading a book last night about God Speaks to Modern Man is the name of the book. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is definitely coming back. Mm-hmm. And so I pray that the eyes of men and women will be opened. And I think to some degree they have been because of this recent terrorist activity. But I pray that the eyes of men and women will be open before that great day. Because I'm telling you, from that instant on, it'll be too late. You see? Mm-hmm. So it seems like the Lord is working well in your life, and I pray that you know the Lord.
Oh, thank you.
I mean it. Because nothing else in this life mm-hmm. matters. Mm-hmm. Like that. Mm-hmm. So as I said, I think there's been a great falling away. I know in my lifetime, the fire in the church, and this is not singling out any one church, mm-hmm. but the fire in churches, many churches, has dwindled down to just a flicker rather than a flame. And
but it's still there.
It's still there. It's still there. It's believe me, and God, in essence, will always be there. See, but many. Scripture tells us that broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, but narrow is the way that leads to everlasting life. See, and it says narrow is the way, and few there be who find it. See. But I guess that would be my statement on that.
Okay, yeah. My statement. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So you said a last statement. Well, let me say that you've been very, very kind and very nice to work with in this. And I pray that I haven't said anything that would be offensive to anybody who might read what you print.
We are going to give you a chance to review the text before it is all going up next. And
right, and I've only given my perception of you know, things as I saw them. But I don't believe that is very far off. I don't believe it's very far off at all. And I would just say that I wouldn't want anyone to think that that my view of the past is negative at all. Uh-huh. I want you to know that I've had a life that I wouldn't change. And let me also say this in wrapping it up. You know, I thank God. I thank God, and I hope you will put this on tape. I thank God for the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful lady who came into my life
as
as my wife, And I will say that we have been married for many, many years. And it doesn't mean that every day has been peaches and cream, but it does mean that, that it has been a glorious experience in my life. And first in my life would be, if I were to rate the things in my life that are most meaningful, of course, the first thing would be becoming a Christian. But second, and a very close second, would be marrying my dear wife. Mm-hmm. And third would be the wonderful family, mm-hmm. children and grandchildren that I have. And she says to me, she's never seen a man who loves his family so much. But I do. Oh. And even right now, you know, we're expecting to go later this weekend, on Thursday, as a matter of fact, and see our youngest daughter and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And man, we can hardly wait. Mm-hmm. We're like children waiting for Christmas Day. It's the truth.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, right. Well, that puts your life into perspective. Those are pretty wonderful things to be happy about.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to turn this off now.
Okay.
Thank you so much.